Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, how's it going? This is Ben, this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thank you for joining me. Welcome along if you're a new listener. Where have you been? We've 46 episodes in here. And hello if you're a regular listener, especially if you've made a donation or signed up for a small recurring monthly payment. You know who you are, I know who you are, you're awesome. Please do me a huge favour and subscribe on iTunes and leave a brief review there. Go on, it only takes 60 seconds. You can make a small donation via the website, and if you need a shiny new Squarespace website, let me know and I'll do you one. What more is there to say? What else? All the optimists who said maybe it won't be as bad as we think it will have fallen silent, and everyone's now realising that it's not only as bad as we feared it would be, but in many ways it's worse. And it will almost certainly get worse still before this nightmare is over. So I don't know what to say. How are normal, sane people supposed to pass what's happening in the United States? Search me. My guest this week is Bryony Campbell. Bryony is London-based, works both as a photographer and increasingly as a filmmaker. Here's what she says on her website. Quote, I work with photography and video to tell stories about who we are and how we understand each other. I shoot promos, documentaries, events and campaigns for arts, education, research and social innovation clients. End quote. She has a master's degree in photojournalism and documentary photography from the London College of Communication, and her graduation project in 2009 received widespread attention and was therefore instrumental in getting her career off to a flying start. The Dad Project was Bryony's attempt to document and make sense of her father's terminal cancer and his eventual death. Her more recent ongoing project, Love in Translation, explores stories about British African couples living in Africa and will soon be showcased on a dedicated website at loveintranslation.net. Bryony will be showing the work and talking about the project at Photo Forum here in London at the Print Space on February the 14th. See what they did there? These things aren't just thrown together, you know. There's smart people behind these things who actually think about this stuff. It's all free. So go along if you are in London and you're interested in seeing more of the project. In the meantime, talking about all that and more is Bryony Campbell. Why don't we start at the beginning?
Seems logical.
It is. Chronological. Logical. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what. Yeah, I mean, your dad became a very kind of important character in your career because of the fact that, sadly, your first kind of big story was the documentation of his illness and subsequent death. So I was going to ask you about him because he was an interesting character, wasn't he? Tell me what he did.
Yeah, he was a psychologist and family therapist initially, and went on to kind of organisational psychology as well. And he taught, and he set up a lot of courses in different countries. So he was quite a important pioneer in family therapy.
Okay, so what was the sort of nature of his work then? I mean, what was his thing?
What was his thing? That's a good question. So his work with families was, they had various theories that he worked. I'm going to have to think about this question.
Yeah, okay. But basically, yeah, like you say, he was a bit of an innovator in that realm. I don't even know what family therapy, what is that even?
So I guess it was quite new at the time, the idea that the whole family should be treated. If one person's got mental health issues previously, that one person would be treated in an isolated way. And so he was part of bringing this new working model whereby the whole family would be treated. Systemic therapy, is what they called it. I'm feeling like ill-equipped to explain what that is, but he was very much about dialogues between people and how relationships were kind of, you know, understanding relationships was the key to improving your psychological well-being, whether that be in a family or in an institutional setting, which is kind of what he did more of in later life.
Right. So in a way, you were the guinea pigs of, you know, it, I guess, did you feel like a guinea pig in a way? Or were you sort of oblivious to it all as you were growing up? I mean,
I was definitely oblivious. I think he was very he was subtle in his sort of, you know, and of course he must have been analysing us along the way. But I remember growing up and hearing other people say, like, you know, the most fucked up kids have shrinks as parents. And I never sort of felt, I never felt that I was, you know, I was being analysed. And he was very, he was very good at listening and didn't seem to give a lot of opinions. But one of the wonderful things about him that I miss was this ability to sort of listen and propose back to you ideas or solutions to what you might be thinking about, but in a way that you kind of felt you'd come up with them yourself. I felt like he definitely sort of developed me a real sense of self-confidence that I think, reflecting now, you know, he definitely developed that in me, but I just felt like I'd work myself out, you know.
Right, so it sort of happened subtly. But yeah, what could be a more important thing to do as a parent than to develop, you know, to pass on a sense of self-confidence? That's about, if you can do that, you've pretty much nailed it as far as I can see. But yeah, you must have come to a stage where you realised that, you know, because of his professional perspective, that he could, yeah, he must have been bringing a lot of valuable stuff to the parenting equation that you could then benefit from. Did you feel like ultimately that you know, that's been the case?
Yeah, now I certainly do, but I didn't really think about that until probably late teens, I guess, when I became aware of it. I kind of knew what he did for a job, but never sort of made the link that obviously related to him as a parent until mid to late teens. And then I began to sort of see those things and understand a bit more about his work and how it seemed to very much match his personality. That's how I came to understand what he did, as I just demonstrated. I'm not a very technically minded person and can't explain his work in that sort of academic context very easily, but when I started to understand what he actually did and what he was interested in helping people with, I could see that was quite well embodied in him, you know, and whether his character led him to do that kind of work or whether that kind of work influenced his character, I can't quite say because I didn't know him before I was born.
Yeah, but, kind of a chicken and egg thing.
Yeah, exactly. He definitely lived those values in a very generous way.
And he was American. He was born in the States.
Yeah.
And he came here when? In the 70s or something?
Yeah, in mid-70s. Mm. Yeah, he was about 26.
Did you spend time in the States when you were growing up? Did you go? Yeah. You did.
Yeah, my grandparents were there, and we used to visit them almost every summer, every other summer, on a house on a lake.
Nice.
In a kind of absolute American sort of summer camp paradise scene where grandma would bake cookies and we'd go swimming. So I had a very sort of rose-tinted view of America from growing up here.
So you still have, yeah, so it's still a place which, you know, has a significance to you.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Have you ever done any work there?
Yeah.
Photography?
I did a piece called New World, which I did in collaboration with Duncan Robertson. And we did a road trip from Michigan, which is where my grandparents' place was. This was quite shortly after my dad died. And I started thinking about the kind of America that I had grown up with, which was so rose-tinted and very much kind of defined by this cuddly grandparents relationship, and, you know, how now I was seeing America politically as a very different place. And so we decided to take a trip from Michigan and do the country south, sort of, you know, with the idea that most road trips go east to west. So we'd just drive south and see what happened, and without a map. And the plan was that we would define our route by asking somebody along the way where we should go next. And we made little interviews with people. That's what I should have started with. It was on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 that we took off.
All right.
So we were asking people sort of in 10 years, what, you know, what effects can you see from the event? And yeah, we made it into a kind of little multimedia portrait of a journey of a nation, but in one little small journey.
Were you shooting some video at that stage? Because you've You say multimedia.
Yeah, I hate that term, actually.
Really?
I used it. I just find it kind of useless.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because it could mean absolutely anything, couldn't it? But to photographers, it does mean one thing, and I think it still means that. But I also found it funny, like, when that term came about, that photographers seemed to think it was something new. You know, that if you put audio with your pictures, or something really new, or if you made a film made out of stills, you know, but obviously filmmakers have been using stills forever.
Yeah. Yeah, multimedia has been around forever.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess it's been reinvented to some extent, or the possibilities that it presents because of the digital revolution. You know, it's become a lot more accessible, I suppose. To just flit around or incorporate different ways of storytelling that aren't necessarily about stills.
Yeah. I think I'm absolutely like of that generation of the digital revolution. I basically kind of cut my teeth in the dark room, or I became a photographer because of the dark room and the joy of that experience, and then never been in a dark room since.
Really?
That was at uni.
So you, like a lot of people, you fell in love with the dark room.
Yeah.
And so the photography almost came as a consequence of that.
I wouldn't put it like that. No, I loved making pictures, but I think it was, the excitement of seeing them come out.
Mm. Yeah, and in order to see that, you have to go and take them, right? Because, you can't have the one without the other. But I know what you mean, the kind of alchemy of the darkroom.
Yeah, it just felt like a special place. Like I'd always been into making and, making pictures and painting, and something about the magic of the darkroom switched me onto photography. But back to the point about multimedia and digital technology, I kind of grew up as digital technology grew up, and my level of kind of professionalism grew as the cameras did, So when I sort of first came out of uni and got what was a fairly decent digital, but I got it because it meant I could take pictures and not spend money. And that was the only way to make a viable career. And then by the time, basically when my dad got sick, was when the 5D Mark II came out with video. And I thought, let me make some video of my dad. And it's only, it's the same camera, but with an extra feature. It's one button. I don't have to learn much. So I really just sort of, fell into using it because it was just one more step. Although I would say that when I started in photography, I'd always thought since uni, my first time at my BA, that I'd love to make documentaries, and that was like a really enormous challenge to tackle, and that if I mastered photography first, that would stand me in a good position, because it just seemed way easier, one button and you've got something.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to a point where I was like, okay, now it's the time that I should do filmmaking, but it happened really because of my dad's illness. And yeah.
So when did it all start then? When did that photography thing first start? When you were a teenager or something?
Yeah, I think, again, it was my dad who gave me his old camera when I was about 15 or 16. And then I wasn't sort of like suddenly all about photography. I wasn't like carrying it everywhere. I was still like very much into all sorts of making, and then I did an art foundation course after my A-levels and got a bit more into photography there. And then, yeah, it was during my BA that I thought this is the thing for me. And yeah, just as and probably the kind of practical element of I could actually do this for a living also played a part, where you can't pay for a living.
Right. So that was a consideration from the beginning. You were serious about the idea of actually having it as a profession.
Yeah.
So you did a BA and then you did an MA as well.
Yeah. I didn't actually study photography. My BA was in graphic arts.
Oh, okay.
So as I came out of that course, even though I hadn't been taught, I thought, right, I'm going to definitely go for photography and teach myself, really.
Mm. The project, which I guess was your, which kind of kickstarted everything for you, was your MA project, really, or your final assessment project, or however you want to call it. But that was the dad project.
Yeah.
It's kind of poignant, really, because it's what kind of put you on the map. But of course, the whole process was very sad for you. It was because your dad was ill and was dying, and you decided to document the whole process. And I guess it was it a difficult decision? Because I think you kind of struggled with the whole thing as to whether you were actually going to do it or not from the beginning. What was your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was a really difficult decision. Deciding to do it was kind of almost as difficult as doing it, I felt like. And I can say that I probably wouldn't have been able to do it if it wasn't for being on the course. And my tutor at the time, who was John Easterby, was really supportive. And so I had thought maybe I should quit the course and come back after Dad's died, because I can spend the last time with him. But yeah, my tutor said, why don't you try and tell the story maybe? So I thought about it long and hard, and there was kind of two major factors that clinched it for me. And one was when I had talked to other people about it. You know, I'd bring it up all the time because it was just like this massive question in my mind. I'd talk to anyone about it. And a lot of people would sort of then tell me back their own story of losing someone they loved, or grief or illness, and often say like they didn't talk about this kind of thing much. And that really just brought it home to me that it's a subject that isn't talked about much. And it seemed like these people in engaging with me were getting some, you know, getting something out of it, that it was a cathartic thing. And so I thought, okay, if I actually tell this story, it might open some conversations for some other people, not just for us.
Yeah, because you said something which I thought was very interesting, which was about the fact that, you know, you'd always considered that sort of self-reflective type of photography to be, you know, narcissistic in some way. So it was, there was something, it didn't quite sit well with you that it was, you were going to be, well, really we're talking there about the fact that you started including yourself in the project, because I guess initially you're thinking, well, you photograph your dad and you'd photograph, you know, sort of daily occurrences, but then at some point you put yourself in the story. What was the decision? How did that decision come about?
It came about from feeling completely stuck as to how to actually tell this story. I felt like I was really being too gentle with everybody. I would take a lot of pictures of, you know, the light coming through my windows, or the empty milk bottle that felt significant, details that felt significant around either my flat when I was alone or my parents' house, which is the same house that I grew up in. And I started to feel like these are just a kind of narration of my moods, and they're not telling the story. And so in sort of, what else can I do? I just took some selfies, and I kind of thought I wouldn't show them to anybody, but then I did, because I had this nurturing space on the course to show them to just a handful of people, and everybody, you know, unequivocally said, these are telling the story.
Yeah.
You've got to keep doing that.
Because it was as much about your emotional responses to your dad dying as it was about, you know, what was happening to him, right? So it made sense in a way that you would be part of it. I mean, do you actually be in the pictures?
Yeah, absolutely. And I never wanted to tell a story about a man dying, you know, in that kind of simplistic way. And for me, like, any of these things are only important because of how we respond to them. You know, there are many images you can see of people dying that might not create a lot of response in you, because that a dead person is other than you, whereas a live person waiting to lose someone they love could be you, will be you.
Yeah.
It will be everybody at some point.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to that point you were making, really, about the fact that it's not narcissistic if you're simply using your own story as a way to explore some very universal themes. You know what I mean? Like, that's something that's only kind of recently I've realised, and I've been trying to do something similar. But I used to, like, you know, there's people like Cindy Sherman, for instance, you know, who a lot of people come into contact with in when they're studying or whatever. And I used to think, you know, what the fuck? She just takes pictures of herself. How self-involved can you be? You know, she dresses up as movie stars. What the, you know?
Yeah, it just seems that when we were kids,
colossally
right?
Narcissistic. And I just thought, why don't you just get out and have a few beers with, you know, with the girls or something? You know, fucking chill out, girl. You know, and I don't know. Not to pick on Cindy. There's loads of photographers who do that, but you know, in this case, I think it's a very different thing, because what you're trying to do is talk about something which is entirely universal, you know, kind of loss and grief and mortality and all of those things. So, yeah, you did put yourself in the pictures. And did you see it as a kind of collaboration from the start with your dad? I mean, clearly he knew what you were doing and he was all right about it. Mm-hmm. But did you feel it was a collaboration?
Yeah, I felt it was absolutely a collaboration in intent, that we both wanted it to happen and we were both trying to make this thing happen together. But I always felt frustrated that I couldn't communicate quite clearly enough what the thing was to him, you know, like he articulated very clearly, and I started the film with his words about why he wanted to do it. So that was absolutely certain for me that this was a good thing for both of us. But I would go around there every time I would go to visit. I would think, right, on my way there, I'd be like, right, I've got to have like a really nice clear plan so Dad knows like what we're going to do, and we're going to have some sort of methodology, and I'm going to have an outcome that, you know, he probably won't be there to see. But at least I can tell him now what it will be. And I just never did. And every time I'd get there, I'd be like, I'll just take some pictures then and have some conversations.
Yeah, you've said that, you know, you were kind of frustrated by the fact that there wasn't a plan.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to have a plan now?
I've never managed to have a really clear one.
It's horses for courses,
you know?
Right?
Yeah, like I'm definitely... You know, I at the time said, oh, you know, I'm in an emotional state because my dad's dying. So how can I possibly, you know, navigate the rigors of creating a solid methodology? But actually, I'm like that with all my work. Mm. I'm just interested in the thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I just start exploring it and then.
But it's a pretty decent. It's a pretty decent excuse in this case.
It was a good one. It was a good one. But now I'm kind of having to admit that maybe it's just how I am, you know.
But he had something about it that it wasn't just he was trying to please you, as it were. He had his own reasons that, you know, that he thought it might be useful for him to do it as well.
Yeah.
And what were his reasons, or what how did he express those?
That he said that he thought it might help him get to know me a little better, which I think that was like absolutely the magic of it for me, was that I've never been, you know, my professional self around my family, and they definitely had a sense that, or I should say I had a sense that they were a little bit sort of worried and not convinced that photography was a proper career. Through my 20s I kind of got the sense that there was a bit of like, oh, Bernie's still doing that photography thing.
Yeah.
And I would always kind of try and present it to them in as a much more sustainable career than I actually knew it to be.
Right. You had to sell it to them somehow, even if you didn't necessarily believe it yourself.
Exactly. So I always felt that my dad was like very supportive of me, you know, following my aims, but he was also a practical person and would like to know that my aims were leading to a secure career. And I didn't feel like they really got down with why I was in it and how much it just felt like the right thing for me, and that was the main factor. That wasn't quite enough for them, you know. So by doing this thing together, it was sort of, that was the second reason I was going to say that was a clinching factor in why I should do it, was that I was working with my dad, and I've never done that before, and obviously would never have another chance.
And I think, you know, you said another thing was that it's very difficult to tell someone else's story in a truthful way. And this would have to be truthful because it was, you know, it was your story. So by definition, it's truthful. But do you really think it's difficult to tell someone else's story in a truthful way?
Yeah.
As a photographer, because that's generally what we try to do.
Mm, I think so. I sort of feel that for myself, and I can only speak for myself, I think that the answer to that question is different for everybody. And if you feel that you have told a truth, then you have, as long as you admit it's only one truth. You know, every story has its limits and every story will leave out a lot of things. Even my story about my dad, I can say that's the truest story I can tell because it's something that I am the only one I can tell my relation, who can tell the story of my relationship with my dad. But that doesn't mean it's the whole truth. Like, my mum sees my relationship with my dad differently. My brother sees it differently. My dad sees it differently. You know, at least in telling the story about your own relationship with a family member, there's kind of nobody else who could, I don't know, I could talk forever about this. You know, potentially no one else could be offended, or they could be offended, but they haven't got a right to be because you're telling your story. If you're telling someone else's story, there's, you know, all that many other spheres of people who could also tell that story, if it's somebody who's not part of your life, and their stories are all perhaps truer than yours as you know, an external observer. So yeah, I can say that for me, like, I would never you know, publish anything that I didn't feel was true. But to get to the point where I feel like this is true is something I really struggle with, to the point that I'm like, I shouldn't be doing this documentary thing, you know, if I can't just be like, okay, here's a story, let it be a limited story, you know. That's something that's
yeah, because in a way you've got to be all in a way. You can't kind of pull back, and especially if it's, you know, like, if it is a very personal thing, it's like, you know, you've got to be courageous enough to just really put yourself in a very vulnerable position and put yourself,
put cards on the table,
yeah, right out there. And how about your mum? Was she comfortable with the whole thing, or did you have to sort of sell it to her, as it were?
Well, I sort of felt at the beginning that I should sell it to her. And then I was surprised that I wasn't required to. Like, I said it to her and my brother, and they both sort of went, yeah, okay. Like, I felt like they hadn't thought that much about it and whether it might have certain impacts on them. But then I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to make a big deal out of it if you're not going to. So I just carried on, and occasionally mum would say, like, oh, I look so tired, why are you taking a picture today? And I obviously desperately didn't want to make anything more stressful than it already was. So didn't photograph her a lot. Didn't photograph my brother a lot, and very much focused on me and dad. But then at the end, I had a kind of amazing moment when, I mean, and I had sensed that during the final weeks and days, that they had both recognised more and more the value of the project, and seeing that my dad was still having this way to be productive if we engaged, and I took a photo. It was like he gave me something, and really, he really lived to be engaged, you know, and to have conversations with people. So so I sensed that they were getting more convinced about it. And then when we left his body behind, mum said, do you want me to take a picture of you and dad? And I couldn't believe it at that moment, and I just thought, have I got it wrong all the way through, you know? Was she actually on board? And I didn't know if I'd photograph his dead body. I didn't think I'd take a picture of me with him until we got there. And then to that moment, and I did take pictures. And then my mum said that, and I thought,
it's very generous of her to say that in time of such incredible grief. And there was a sort of turning point, I think, at one point, which was this thing with the smashed glass. Can you just kind of explain what happened there?
Oh, yeah. So I have this picture, which is just a splash on the floor, which it didn't quite occur to me till after, but a lot of people read it as a blood splash.
Yeah,
sort
totally.
Of brown.
Looks like blood.
Yeah, but it was a milkshake, a chocolate milkshake, and my dad was drinking. It was like an energy drink for people to regain strength. And it was wobbly and dropped the glass and smashed on the floor. And it was a sort of slightly traumatic moment, and mum was really stressed. And I was stood there in the middle of them with my camera around my neck. And in my head, I was thinking, I need to take a picture. Like, look, everybody's upset. This is a sick man doing a thing that sick men do, and his wife getting stressed. This is the story. And I couldn't take a picture. And I just stood there. And then I got the dustpan and brush out, and I was just beating myself up, like, that was the picture and you're not doing this. And I cleared up the glass, and then I thought, let me just take a picture. This splash of milkshake looks kind of pretty, and I can just remember this moment because, you know, this was important that I failed. And I took that picture, and then after I realized that actually that picture, and the fact that I couldn't take the, you know, a more explicit image of the people being upset, was very much part of the project, and that kind of symbolized this conflict between being a daughter and a photographer, which there couldn't be a perfect balance between that. So I had to accept that I'd sort of swing between one and the other. And it also made me realize that sometimes that what's outside of the frame can still be part of the story.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you said something to the effect that you realized that the fact that you couldn't shoot everything was the story, essentially.
Yeah.
Leonie Hampton gave you an interesting tip, which was try and shoot love.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting and very touching. But how the hell do you then do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have the same question?
Not really. I sort of I remember, yeah, because I wrote that in my essay about it, didn't I? Because it really stuck with me, and I think I suppose I'd probably been instinctively trying to do that, but until she said it in those words, I didn't sort of concentrate on how it might be in my images, and in a way, how the hell did you do that? But I think I probably took that on as a sort of I don't know. I felt like it made sense, but now that I'm trying to explain it to you, I'm not sure how it does.
No, it makes perfect sense, but then you have to then figure out how, you know, how you might, I suppose just having it in your mind,
yeah,
is enough.
Yeah, it's
in my
mind, and I think it it encouraged me to take even softer images, you know, or sort of softer details.
I mean, there is a lot of tenderness evident, and I guess that's as close as you need to get. I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's very much evidence of a great deal of love in them. So you obviously, did you achieve it to your satisfaction?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. All these years later, how do you sort of look back on it now? How have you sort of, you know, considered it in retrospect?
I feel like enormously grateful to photography that I could have that, you know. Because I don't think there's any equivalent thing that I could have as, you know, an actual product as well as an experience that I'll carry with me forever, as well as continual conversations. You know, this is like, how many years is it? 7? And you're still interested in talking about it. I still get invited to give lectures about it, and especially, yeah, younger people, students seem to really engage with that project above anything else. And that's such a magical thing that, you know, my dad last week met a bunch of students in Coventry, you know, they know something about him. He can't meet them, but in a way, like they've met him. And like I said at the beginning, I think people who lose someone they love usually feel like they don't get enough chance to talk about it, and I get these chances all the
time.
Yeah,
yeah, because there's a sort of awkwardness to it that, you know, other people are very uncomfortable, not sure how to approach it, and you know, it's a very common situation that people find themselves in, where actually they'd rather talk about it than sort of people standing around kind of not knowing how to talk about it. So yeah. You've given yourself that opportunity.
This is how we'll talk about it, kind of thing, you know.
So you're doing a thing now where you're mentoring terminally ill people. How did that come about? Has it sort of come as a result of that project, or is it coincidental?
Yeah. In a roundabout, I mean, yeah, that's why I actually was invited to, which was it was a happy coincidence, because I'd actually written a proposal to do that very thing in Marie Curie hospices, which is where my dad died, and I proposed doing this with them, and they were keen, and in the end didn't have the budget to do it. And then shortly after that, completely out of the blue, a film lecturer called Michelle Aaron from Birmingham University got in touch, and she had got funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council to do the same thing, but very much from an academic perspective. So that funding body funds social research in the arts and humanities. It generally goes through an academic institution, with the outcome being research, you know, papers. But the kind of front line, as it were, of this research would be a filmmaker supporting terminally ill people to use video. And yeah, through the DAB project, she heard about me and asked if
okay.
I would do that.
So what, you know, mentoring, it seems almost like a strange word to use, but what, how does it actually look? What are they doing?
Once a week, I go to this hospice in the outskirts of Birmingham. And depending how much of the process you want to know, it was quite a very slow process to sort of get it going, because obviously there's in an institution like that, there's various people to kind of get on board. But once we eventually got the patients invited, they would come. And obviously with terminally ill people, there's a million variables that mean nobody can give you any commitment about how often they're going to be there and how long they're going to be there and how they're going to feel about it each week. So it's very much a kind of open flowing thing that I just have to respond to whatever anyone needs on 1 week. But yeah, essentially I went once a week for the last 2-ish months, and we sort of got about 6 people who engaged in it. And once we got them together, I was amazed how well it went. You know, I was really concerned that people might, you know, obviously not everybody speaks a creative language and might be quite intimidated by that process. And I suppose I would say that the majority, at least half the people who came, kind of already had their own, you know, creative practice mostly in a hobbyist way, but we're into that. And then they definitely, you know, I introduced what we were going to do and showed the DAB project and talked about my experience and we showed some other work. But then they started exchanging ideas. You know, it's been as much a kind of art therapy session as a kind of aiming towards an output. But, you know, their experiences would resonate with each other so much that, you know, in some sessions it was kind of they led it more than me, which was great. And yeah, a lot of them, well, I'd say half of them came quite quickly to an idea of what they might like to make. It's been very much more about ideas and expressing their feelings than it has been about technical filmmaking.
Yeah.
And again, for practical reasons, that's sort of how it needs to be.
What have been the challenges for you then?
Yeah, there have been various sort of change along the way. So currently I'm very much struggling with the kind of authorship question, whereby, you know, most of them couldn't make a film on their own. Most of them are not very technically minded, and some of them got a brilliant woman who's got dementia, and she's extremely sort of expressive and real sort of engaging character. But with the dementia, there'd be no way that she could sort of construct a narrative, and you know, from week to week, sort of retaining what we've said doesn't really work. So I really have to be the filmmaker there in a way, you know, even though she's shooting, I kind of have to be a director in a way. And then there's other people who are really doing it themselves and can, you know, and have an idea, and I just say, that's a good idea, I like this, you know, just act more like a tutor in a course. So yeah, that feeling of sort of what is the priority here? Is it getting an output? We have an exhibition planned for their work in Birmingham in May. And so we would like them to be able to show something in it, because that would obviously be a positive outcome for them. But then, you know, so am I sort of pushing somebody towards an outcome because I want them to have an outcome, whereas probably is the process more important, and the fact that it might come to nothing, does that matter? And because I have much more instincts about how best they could get to an outcome, I'm struggling with whether I should, you know, push those
right
agendas or not.
So this is fundamentally a video project for all of them.
Yes.
You're doing more video, I think. Are you kind of moving slowly towards that being your main thing, or is that already your main thing? Maybe you've always mixed it up.
Yeah, I've always mixed it. Well, I have for the last sort of 5-6 years, and I would love to continue mixing it up. Recently I'm making more video for clients than stills. I mean, yeah,
right,
I'm hired more to do video.
So in terms of earning a living,
it's definitely made a big difference. And I sort of, you know, on any one day that you ask me, I might feel differently about, right, no, it's all about video. I mean, obviously video tells stories more clearly, etc. Love it. And then I'll sort of spend some time with stills or looking at other people's stills and go, oh, but you know, the simplicity of that moment and that satisfaction of getting a still just right is that sort of unparalleled by video, which is so much more about process. So I love them both, I would say, equally, but I do feel that video's given me it sort of got me over a problem that I felt I was facing with stills. I couldn't tell stories clearly enough. It didn't say enough. You know, I didn't feel there was 1,000 pictures in each, a thousand words in each picture. And with video, suddenly I was like, okay, yeah, now you can tell a whole.
Right.
Whole story.
Yeah, again, I think it's, you know, horses for courses, and you know, you have to pick whatever seems the right way of telling whatever that story is. And I guess it could be whatever. It could be, you know, paintings, or it could be a video. So I wanted to ask you about Love in Translation, which is an ongoing project which you've been working on for a while, and you now have a dedicated website. So if people go to your normal website, they'll find stuff that's been up there for a while.
They will, yeah.
Actually, you have been beavering away on this, and you've got a whole website now dedicated to the project. So tell me what the project is.
So it's called Love in Translation. I previously was calling it Britain Loves Africa. So, and I have sort of shared that occasionally. But yeah, I've been beavering away and not showing much of it, and changed the name and made lots of changes. But essentially, it's stories about British African couples living in African countries. So whereby there's a British immigrant who has a partner who's a local African. And when I met them, they were couples. This was about 5 years ago, coming on for 6 years. And now they mostly all have kids, and so I've returned to them over the years, recording their kind of family life and relationships.
It's quite an unusual subject matter in a way. How did you come to it? I think you had a formative experience, because you went to Zanzibar when you were young and you fell in love with some local kid. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I was 19 and I went on one of these teaching English placements.
So was that your first time in Africa?
I had been as a teenager, but my dad was doing some work in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And we went just for a holiday. So this was my first time sort of independently. So I was on this teaching placement and became very aware of this strange sort of status that I had as a white person. And, you know, it's a pretty questionable situation, all these British teenagers getting sent out to teach in African schools when, you know, I didn't speak Swahili and I didn't have any teaching experience. And on the flip side, you know, in our village school, most of the teachers didn't have any teacher training. The English teacher didn't really speak English. So, you know, you're kind of sat in the middle of this strange dynamic of, you know, whether you're doing any good or just sort of continuing a sort of, you know, colonial agenda of the sort of white saviour. So that, you know, that became like really present in my mind at that time. And sort of coloured my view of white people in Africa. Although I didn't really meet any white people in Africa, and I sort of had this judgment of them. And because we were living in quite an ordinary village, and Zanzibar is like a classic paradise island where there's very luxurious places for tourists to hang out, but not many opportunities for education and employment for local people. And then I fell for this boy who worked in the bar that we used to hang out, and that relationship kind of got me much closer to, you know, the communities there, and suddenly I felt like I was sort of let in to another whole nother dimension of it. But of course, between us, we still, you know, we didn't have a shared model of what a relationship was, and it was very sort of clumsy and equally constantly exciting,
you know? Yeah.
And so I got really fascinated with those relationships between foreigners and locals, and quite a particular dynamic in Zanzibar, because there is a big tourist industry, so you've got the whole kind of holiday romance, sex tourism question. But then and I travelled a bit more around Southern and East Africa and just, felt just really curious about these relationships and how a real one might work, you know, a really sustained one. That was the motivation was this.
So that was the kind of impetus for the whole thing. Did you have it in mind that, you know, you wanted to somehow explore it as a project, or did it just come back to you later on? Because it must have been, it was quite a few years before you.
A lot later, Yeah, no, I didn't think I'd explore that. I then started taking pictures with sort of young ambitious Africans. In my 20s, I went back and hung out with hip-hop musicians in Kenya and partied with a lot of people who were having a good time and wanted to depict this sort of energetic, optimistic scene. But I got back to my question of, like, the white girl with the camera being part of this dynamic, and I didn't want to play that role, so...
This whole thing about the white girl with the camera status, you know, what, just kind of explain a little more about what that means to you.
It means to me that I know that all my encounters are affected by the fact that I'm white when I'm in Africa. You know, I could get an invitation through most doors.
Fact that you've got a camera, more so?
Yes. I think so. Well, I would say even more so in many circumstances. Mm. Obviously, that depends on the individual. But certainly when you're trying to meet young people, and, you know, if I'm trying to meet musicians and people with ambitions, they want to be photographed, of course. And I represent a photographer who might take their picture to somewhere, you know,
sure,
important.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I felt my interactions were superficial at all. I sort of... I made relationships with people that felt quite solid and positive, but I still knew that, you know, that was a factor, basically. And partly sort of carrying that colonial inheritance that I didn't want to be the one, you know, people use the phrase like to give a voice to people, and I'm sort of troubled by that, like they've got their voice just because they don't know how to make pictures as well as I do. You know, I can give them a voice maybe by taking pictures of them, but it's my voice talking about them. It's back to that issue, which I think, you know, I've sort of come to realize it is just sort of part of me, but it's enhanced by being a white girl in Africa with a camera.
So what is the sort of aim, as it were?
To look at that kind of most intimate point of connection between two cultures that have this very conflicting history. You know, they're absolutely inextricably intertwined, you know, Britain and the African countries that were colonized. And those are the ones that I've most focused on. That's very much, you know, you go to Uganda or Tanzania, you can see British influences everywhere, not least that, you know, a lot of people speak English, but you can see those influences everywhere. And so how do you, as a person of the next generation, enter that society in the right way? Like, what is the right way to do it, and how do you do it right? And, you know, there's a lot of people of our generation working in the aid industry, which... you know, supposedly a, you know, the West being generous, and you could certainly argue a very good case that it's just perpetuating the kind of colonial control. I sort of felt troubled by seeing people living in massive houses on massive salaries and then going out to the bush and teaching people to use condoms, which, you know, again, like every opinion I would form while I was there, I'd also see the flip side just as clearly, which was that people should learn to use condoms because there's a lot of HIV. So, you know, nothing was ever simple.
Right. So you're constantly having your kind of prejudices challenged or you know, you're reconsidering your position on everything.
Yeah, exactly. And I like putting myself in that position. So I guess, you know, part of the project was just me putting myself deeper into that position and wriggling around.
Which is kind of what it seems to me is what photography allows one to do, and it's one of the great things about it. You know, you just put you know, you're obliged to just examine something in a depth that you just wouldn't otherwise even consider it.
Exactly. It's absolutely like a ticket into places that you wouldn't get.
Yeah, so, and to try and understand things on a level that, you know, you just wouldn't otherwise
exactly.
bother. So you've got, so what's the new website? Give us the address.
So it's loveintranslation.net, which, as I say it, I realise is not going to be live by the time this blog is live.
Podcast.
But
everyone says blog.
Sorry,
no, it's podcast. Fine. It's what people say.
But it will be soon.
Okay, so you're right, yeah.
On Feb 14th, I'm going to present it at Photo Forum.
Yep. Exactly. I was going to say, so Photo Forum, so that's for London-based people. I'm always slightly aware of the fact that, you know, my imaginary listener in Kansas City will not be able to make it. But a lot of my listeners are in London and people know about Photo Forum, but it's a brilliant thing. And it's every second Tuesday. And it's at the Print Space, which is a place a lot of photographers in London know about. It's in Clerkenwell. It's in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Photo Forum, brilliant thing, which normally involves a particular photographer presenting their work or talking about their work. And you're up on February the 14th. So anyone who's in London wants to see more about Love in Translation should go along. But yeah, you're going to be obviously you're going to be showing the pictures, and you're also going to be talking
some
video. Oh, and some video as well, right?
Yeah. So this project is very much both, and actually more and more so video. I'm actually cutting short films. So there's five families that I've mainly focused on, and as well as this still series, I'm cutting short films for each family, which has sort of been a slow process, and I'll be making them sort of as and when. I've made one, nearly two, and this is also a project that I hope to do forever. So the cute little kids that you can see in my pictures now, I'd like to interview them when they're sort of wondering which country they're going to live in.
Okay, right. So you're really intending on making it a very long-termer.
Yeah.
And you're gonna just keep in touch with all these families.
Yeah.
To the point where the children who we're now seeing in the pictures will ultimately end up being shown in their adulthood. That will be interesting.
That's the dream.
It's a big commitment, but you're confident you'll stick with it, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I can make the commitment, but obviously the families could change their mind at any point.
Sure. Yeah, of course, there's always that danger.
And yeah, it's very much, you know, about finding the means to do it.
How are you funding it? How have you funded it so far?
So the first time around, I've only made three trips over there in the 5 years, but each time I go for a couple months or so. First one I funded myself. Basically still living with my parents then, saving up. And then second one, I actually won prize money for the Dad Project, which I then put towards it. And the third trip, I got an Arts Council fund. That was great. And that's sort of what that was funded, this website. So this kind of bringing the first chapter to an audience, that was an Arts Council.
Mm. Tell me about one of the couples. Pick one and tell me something about them.
Okay. Oh, which one should I pick? I feel like they've all got
interesting
things, and they're all quite different. There's parallels, but they're all quite different. Carla and Matteo, I'll tell you about, because they're sort of the ones I've known the longest. And I think they're very interesting in that she is sort of the most integrated, I would say. She speaks fluent Swahili. They're in Tanzania, where Swahili is the main language. And she had been on the continent and mainly around East Africa for quite a few years before she met Matteo. He's still living in his local neighbourhood. He's kind of like a very local guy and a kind of bit of a figure in the community now, because he runs a successful business, which was his dad's road smoothing business that he's sort of developed. So they're quite wealthy and very much of a kind of middle class African community. You know, Carla's got local friends who are white or British and things, but they're very much embedded in their community. They live opposite their mother. They live opposite, around the corner from the sister. So they've all got these houses in this kind of, what is quite a kind of new suburb of a large town in the north called Arusha. So they're very much kind of their generation, to my mind. They're not living in the kind of previous white suburbs.
Yeah, they're not in some kind of gated community or something where they're
well, no, they're very gated. And that's the interesting thing.
Oh, really?
That's an interesting thing.
But it's not just expats, you know, sort of sticking together and not like you say, kind of
mixing.
Yeah,
exactly. So, but that sort of, again,
they're gated in the sense of their middle class, they're kind of,
anyone who owns more than the average African, which is very little, will put up a gate and have guards and have staff. So that was something, that's why I find them an interesting dynamic, because that's something that I really associated with a kind of colonial lifestyle, but actually it became so much a part of life that, you know, if you had wealth you had to protect it. You know, there was no investment in social services, and therefore poor people are very poor, and there's not a reliable policing system, and therefore people get private security, and you need to employ people, so hiring somebody to be a security man is helping somebody out who wouldn't have a job. So, you know, it's become so much a part of society that everybody does it now. And then you see this sort of role reversal whereby Carla, who's grown up in a quite liberal, like her parents are artists in countryside in Norfolk, like a bit hippie-ish.
Yeah.
You know, fell in love with Africa and all the kind of richness of its cultural history and arts. And then her partner is sort of this successful local guy who hires people, and he's quite like strict with his staff, and she's like way softer and like wants them to come in and watch telly and have the same dinner she's having, and he wants them to stay in their little houses where they live and cook their own food, which is the same every day. And, you know, so that kind of dynamic that you wouldn't really predict of one of those couples.
No, exactly. You know, yeah, it's really the same old kind of marital questions of, you know, how do you deal with those differences of approach? And
exactly.
Of
and when it comes down to it, it's like, yeah, just two people working out their differences. Yeah. And she's also bringing up lots of stepkids,
that
his kids from previous partners, and they've now got a daughter of their own. And so she's this real, like, what looks to me like a real typical African mum. Middle-class African mum, you know, she's got help, she's got a nanny, and yet she's, you know, constantly different kids coming in and out the house, and everyone treats it like it's their own house, and that kind of atmosphere that you just don't get here anymore, that I think, you know, it's kind of wonderful for kids to grow up with, where everyone's your brother and sister.
Must be great. It really brings it alive when you start talking about these people, and it's made me think, oh man, I've really got to, now I'm going to the website and I'm going to, you know, look at all these stories, because I'm really interested to hear more about all of these people and you know, who they are. And so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to doing that. We can't go into it now because we haven't got time really, but it's just nice to get a little flavour of, you know,
and they're all really different.
Are you hoping to make a book
of this project?
Yeah
but that would be like the way
down the road, because it's an ongoing thing. So when's the end point, kind of thing? When's the appropriate time to do a book if you're going to be still shooting in 10-15 years time?
Exactly, right? Yeah. But I feel like with these kind of stories, you know, it's not that it's such an incredibly unusual story, you know, it's not shocking, it's not news. And the pictures, though, you know, I think there's beautiful pictures in there, they're not sort of so remarkable. I don't know, for me, making a book has to be like, that book has to be something that stands on its own. And I could make a book, but I don't feel like it would be nearly as powerful as it will be when these become stories with a real duration, you know?
Yeah.
For now, I feel like, whether it's my words or in the voices of the couples themselves, that we really need the words in there, you know, like, you became a lot more interested by hearing me describe them.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it personalises it and it brings it all to life. And I think, you know, that...
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
You know, for me, I think, you know, photography at its best is a kind of emotional engagement. And so when you're looking at people's lives and, you know, people's stories, then knowing something about them is, it really brings it another dimension. Yeah. But then again, having said that, that's made me realise that there's also a whole side to it whereby I'm talking to Bika Deporta, and you know, she doesn't put any captions on her pictures, and they're equally
interesting.
They're very compelling, because actually you can create your own backstory. So what am I saying? Both is great, I guess. That's basically
exactly. It's that question of, am I more interested in leaving people wondering, which is
a
brilliant
exactly.
thing to do. For me, that's really the essential difference between stills and video. Like, if you want to give people something to wonder about, put it in a still. And if you want to give people a story to, like, fully, that they can, you know, get into, then a video does it better.
Right.
And I sort of like leaving people wondering, but actually I feel like, in a way, that's harder for me to do with that kind of, you know, the duty of conveying somebody's truth, is that I can show you pictures of these people that will make you think one thing about them. And I know that you're getting an impression of them that either I or they wouldn't think is the right one to get, you know, and I can show you another picture which conveys them completely differently, of course. So, yeah, I want to, because I feel like this, the subject, and the reason that I'm looking at the subject is because it's one that is often sort of misconstrued. You know, there's like total massive stereotypes about the kind of, you know, the rich white man with the hot young African women, which, you know, doesn't come from nowhere. That happens a lot, and I do have one couple like that in the project.
And also the like you say, the kind of middle-aged female sex tourist with the young African
exactly
guy,
everybody,
you know,
knows those
cliches abound. Yeah,
so I feel like, you know, my purpose of looking into this subject was to go beyond those stereotypes, and also to have a conversation about the very complicated dynamics of colonial inheritance and how that plays out now. So I can't tell this in a few pictures, you know what I mean? It has to be thorough.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I make a book in maybe 10 years, or, you know, I don't know how fast time will pass. I'd like to wait longer to make the book, but I might be like, I'm never going to do this for 20 years. But then that would be a big story, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be...
Save it for your dotage, Bryony.
Yeah.
Do it when, you know, when you're about done, and it will be like a massive career's worth of stuff.
Yeah, when I'm in my slippers.
Yeah.
I'm not too weak to shoot anymore.
Exactly. Well, long may it continue. I look forward to... checking it all out on the website, which I have only just become aware of. As you say, it's not yet, you're not too keen on actually making it public, because it's not quite finished, but
I had to say that the address I told you isn't even, there's nothing there yet.
Okay.
But
all right.
in 2 weeks,
so
people could be listening to this podcast at any time,
of course, in a year's time.
loveintranslation.net,
yeah, they
will
can find
be
it
there.
All right, great, thank you very much. It was lovely to talk to you, and
thank you.
Thanks for doing it.
No problem. Very much a pleasure. And thanks for making this podcast, because it's a lot of work, and a lot of people enjoy it.
Thank you. Bless you. That's very sweet of you to say so.